talk about are conversations that follow the program, projects, and participants of Walk and Talk's multiple editions. They exist to map and move ideas between geographies, and in the 9.5 edition, they become a podcast series with 10 episodes made available throughout the festival. Multiple voices to imagine new common spaces. Talk about
complexity resilience.
Hi everyone, my name is Colin Self, and I'm an artist, composer, and performer based primarily in Berlin, Germany. And I'm really happy to be a part of this Walk and Talk conversation series today to sort of focus on this concept of complexity resilience. It's a kind of terminology that I'm new to, that was introduced to me by my friend Lynn in this time that we were kind of discussing how to live and move through a world that is constantly challenging and transforming and giving us unprecedented circumstances, and sort of living in unprecedented times in which everything that we kind of experience is new, and how to navigate living in that world. How do we create a resilience, or how do we kind of cultivate something for ourselves and for others in which you can take care of yourself and your loved ones and people who live in the margins during these times. So I wanted to start this episode by talking a little bit about something that I do called Choir. It's spelled X-O-I-R, and it's a group singing practice that I started back in 2011, 2012, when I was in an artist residency with my friend Raul De Nieves. And choir, over many years, has transformed and become so many different things, but was sort of initially rooted in this question of why, or curiosity of why, there was not more forms for group assembly, for being together as singing creative voices that was not also rooted in memorizing and reciting sheet music. I thought it was really strange that any of the opportunities that were readily available to me in New York all had to do with, you know, this sort of formal way of gathering. So I think that my initial relationship to this concept of complexity resilience has to do with how we relate to each other in a physical space, the sort of toolkit that we can kind of grant each other with something like singing or relating to the voice, something that I feel maybe I know better than other things because I'm a singer and a performer. And later in today's episode, we're going to talk to my friend Caroline Cantillo, who is a meditation instructor, facilitator, incredible human being, longtime collaborator of mine. And but first, maybe I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about choir as and some of the things that we do within choir that are aimed at helping create a resilience. Maybe I should start by saying that something that happened over the years was that singing together as a group transformed from being something that was just about the politics of assembly and creating a community to also becoming kind of a platform for research, for learning, not just for my own research, but then trying to grant other people with the ability to curiously investigate their relationship to their voice and to what it means to be singing or making sound with others. So something that I was turned on to a couple years ago when I had a spine injury, that's a whole nother story, is something called polyvagal theory, which relates to the vagus nerve or the 10th cranial nerve. The parasympathetic central nervous system is an autonomic nervous system. I'm going to try to not get too heady here. And the job of the parasympathetic central nervous system does many things, but one of the main roles is to sort of regulate the body's the body's ability to handle stress and trauma. So when we are experiencing a fight or flight moment, when we have that rush of adrenaline, or when you are able to rest and fall asleep, these are all sort of regulated by the parasympathetic central nervous system. And when I was going through a process of spinal healing and learning a lot more about my central nervous system as a place that you could both harbor or like hold stress and trauma in the body, but then also actively engage with it and heal it, I learned that the vagus nerve runs directly through the throat, kind of along the larynx, down into your, connects to some of your vital organs, and eventually goes all the way down to your gonads, genitals, whatever you got going on down there. And so from my interest in exploring these things, I started thinking about singing as a way to sort of activate, and I started looking into other people's research also, as there was a kind of history already at this point of a lot of people who were engaging with this idea of polyvagal healing through singing, through and also singing with others. I was reading a book by Bessel van der Volk, I think is how you say his name, and this book catalogs many stories of stress and trauma, primarily around stories of sexual abuse and war crimes, or people who are experienced war, and kind of perpetually looking for answers of how to undo these things, I eventually arrived at this one chapter in which group singing and kind of group movement, so things that could happen in synchronicity with a group of people, could be a sort of healing process, healing practice. So if you can, maybe I'm going to finish today's episode by leading you, the listener, or, and you can feel free to invite someone else to join you, through some sort of audibly led activation of the polyvagal healing process. And I apologize if anyone is like a trained professional listening to this, that I am very much an amateur. I name all of this as being a kind of curious, a person who's just beginning to unfold my relationship to this process. And so now I wanted to now take a moment to introduce you guys to a friend of mine, Caroline Cantillo. Someone I've known for several years. We met back in, I want to say 2011, maybe, when I was first living or moving to New York. And Caroline has been a collaborator over the years, and also a person who I think has taught me a lot, both in terms of mindfulness and meditation, but then also I think we very much align on our shared interest in healing sound practice. Caroline, maybe you can introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do, where you are, whatever you want to say.
Yeah, totally. So I live in Brooklyn. I've lived in Brooklyn for, I think, almost 18 years at this point. I consider myself a facilitator of contemplative practices and healing arts. And I'm also a climate justice activist. And I'm always looking for ways to kind of thread those two areas of work together. And I do a lot of writing. I like to write. So those are kind of my areas of practice. And yeah, I come from a Buddhist practice background. I was practicing Buddhism pretty intensely for a number of years. And more recently, I've branched into somatic healing practices and sound healing.
Excellent. And I think it's like this ongoing list of, I don't know, things that I also or things that I would aspire to hopefully also arrive at doing. And I always appreciate this sort of like chronology, or like, I guess just seeing this pathway that has been formed between all these different ways of engaging with other people, with weaving sound and activism and mindfulness and all these things together in a way that is, I think, so cohesive I wanted to ask what this, I think just starting with the theme of complexity resilience, of asking what this term maybe means to you, or when you hear complexity resilience, what comes to mind, whether it's a sort of as a practice or as like a or even somatically, just what that is, to hear those, what those words are together.
Also I want to thank you for seeing some of these threads of my work as cohesive, because sometimes I feel like I'm shooting out in many different directions and kind of seeing what works, which is an intuitive practice, and learning to trust that has been really difficult. But I think allowing myself to do that and not feel like, oh, I should really commit to one thing, allowing myself to go in those different directions and then see where they connect has been really important to me. So I just wanted to thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah.
And so complexity resilience. My first encounter with the term resilience came when I was an undergrad at Hunter College and I was studying weather and climate. And this was my introduction to climate change as a topic. Mm. And so resilience in terms of climate change, we were talking about coastal areas. And so resilience as this concept of being able to bounce back. A destructive storm happens. If the town or the area is resilient, it will bounce back and not be completely destroyed by the storm, was kind of how it was presented. That's where I became interested in this term resilience. That was like one of the threads that I went off on. I ended up attending a webinar called Transformational Resilience. Hmm. And this was really interesting. It was led by a group of climate scientists who were also interested in trauma, because they said climate change is going to create new trauma for people and trigger old trauma.
Right.
So how can we address this social impact of climate change in a way that it's not just people bouncing back? Because again, this way that resilience is sometimes used, it's like, oh, a bad thing happens and you bounce back. This person's able to just get over bad things and bounce back. Hmm. But sometimes bouncing back to normal isn't necessarily what you want if that normal baseline is perhaps part of what created the trauma. And I think that's where complexity comes into it with climate change. Climate change is such a huge, complex problem that impacts pretty much all human systems and, you know, earth systems. Mm-hmm. So the idea of bouncing back from things that are happening because of climate change is a little bit of a problem. Mm-hmm. So this concept of transformational resilience is looking at how do you not just bounce back, but how can you let climate change transform you for the better? Hmm. And that was really kind of a revolutionary concept for me, coming from this sort of like city planning resilience perspective that was about designing cities and coastal areas to not be as impacted by climate change, to this idea that a huge stressor or trauma creating situation like climate change could help change us. Hmm. That was pretty new to me, and I really liked that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really potent idea to sort of consider the long-term narrative about resilience being not just about maybe adapting and then being able to return to the way that we are, but then also that it has to be about sort of moving through time, so that whatever the resilience is, that it's a perpetually evolutionary practice of relating to things and It's great to hear sort of, I mean, this is also something that I've always appreciated about the dialogue that we've shared, which is that this thing that's so often overlooked or kind of spoken so infrequently about when talking about climate disaster or climate fighting for climate justice and things like this has to do with how very rarely we regard the emotional or physiological or bodily experience of climate disaster and climate change, and that's both like an individual and a collective problem, and of course affects minorities much more seriously than people who have all the capacity to build that, like you're saying, this world around them that doesn't have to change so much. I'm wondering, with the training that you've done, I'm curious what the processes are, maybe for you as an individual, or what you have felt has been a potent toolkit for you, or any specific things that have helped understand this process of, you called it transformational resilience, of moving through that and learning through that.
So with this concept of transformational resilience, the facilitators talked about how whole communities can get organized around trauma. When they're traumatized and the trauma isn't healed, whole communities start to organize around it. And that's how you get to situations of atrocity, that's like a really startling and stark thing to think that with increased climate disasters, increased population, more populations are traumatized, and then leaning more towards genocide and things like that. So that really kind of lit a fire under my butt to start thinking about what tools might be for working with that. And so I had already been practicing and teaching mindfulness in a Buddhist capacity and organizing Buddhists for things like the People's Climate March. But I think this idea of transformational resilience really introduced the idea of healing to me. I just hadn't taken healing very seriously. I thought of meditation for me wasn't about healing. It was a spiritual path. I was, you know, doing Buddhism pretty rigorously. So I had this, you know, concept of enlightenment. It's a spiritual path towards enlightenment. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily about healing. So once I introduced the concept of healing, that actually trauma can happen to a person, and trauma is anything that overwhelms the nervous system, that the nervous system can't process, feels helpless. The body doesn't have the chance to discharge the fight or flight response, and then all sorts of dysregulation can happen. Mm. Physically, emotionally, et cetera. But that a person can heal from that. That's like a very hopeful thing. Yeah. It's not just what I had previously felt, which was, I don't know, maybe I have a bunch of trauma and I have all of this dysregulation and I just have to sit with that and notice it. It was like, noticing it doesn't necessarily heal it. Sometimes it's actually just making me more aware of my suffering. And then I flee right back into kind of an escapist self-soothing mode, which is an aspect of resilience, actually. It's like all of these things that we do that might be considered addictive behaviors or harmful behaviors are often the nervous system trying to bring itself back into regulation after a trauma.
Right.
So that's the resilience of our nervous system. It's trying to survive. It's trying to help us survive. And sometimes those ways are harmful. So I began looking for ways to cultivate resilience for myself and to practice healing that weren't harmful to my nervous system or harmful to other people. And these were things for me. I had already been practicing, you know, contemplative Buddhist practices, but this brought me to a sound healing training that I did, which was just absolutely revolutionary for me. This idea that sound can be used to bring the nervous system and the body and the spirit and the heart and the mind back into regulation after it's been dysregulated by trauma. And that trauma can be, you know, acute trauma like a car accident. It can be systemic trauma like oppression. All of these things can, you know, from, it's less about the specifics of what caused the trauma than the fact that your nervous system felt overwhelmed by it. So then bringing tools to bring these systems back into balance can create, that's part of healing. And healing isn't necessarily going back to exactly how things were. It's like when you think of physical healing, it's like sometimes there's a scar or there's, you know, a fissure in the bones, and you have to learn new ways to work with that. But healing to me was more about moving towards things that are nurturing and that inspire the natural growth and healing that my body and mind want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think so much about this, like, how do you say, like, in having it being this kind of moving thing, or maybe that we both, in having an interest in sort of, like, sound as it relates to healing, have both probably a shared experience of how, and maybe people listening to this could also relate to this thing of that participating in sound, either production or the absorption of sound, is like, it can be an extremely transformative activity, even if it's just literally playing a sound on your, or a song on your phone or computer speakers, whatever. And yeah, I mean, I was just also thinking about The Body Keeps the Score, this Bessel van der Volk, is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
The Body Keeps the Score. And when I was reading this kind of book that does, I think, a really intense but great job of cataloging different kinds of trauma, and that I, in the looking for, in my search for sort of trying to find something that felt as though it was being presented as like a solution to all of these things, that the first thing that really stuck out to me were these stories about sound and music, in which the, whether it was about people doing synchronized singing or breathing or dancing, and that in moving in space and making sound with each other, that it actually was able to create a kind of collective healing, or like undo some of the stress that the body has to not trust other bodies, which seems like such a radical thing. And in some ways it's so simple to sort of think about a solution to, I don't know, for us to have our own arsenal of what can bring us towards resilience could have to do with engaging with each other this way. But then also that, like, because we have been, so I'm just thinking about the everyone coming from being in this place of isolation and now moving into this moment where we're seeing tons of protests, that I think so much of what is healing, or what is a sort of vibrant fire beneath Black Lives Matter, all of the sort of human rights protests that are happening in the world right now, and hopefully continue to happen, come from this kind of need for all of us to kind of find a way to heal. I mean, it also is, it's also dangerous at the same time, where we have, like, you know, only some, I definitely feel like if I am in those spaces, I have to be distant to people. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's something to say about the sort of process of collective assembly, even if it is at a distance, as relating to this thing. And also, I don't know if there is a way for that practice or that learning to be sort of simple, or not so heady, that like it is like a very simple thing. I don't know. I'm like rambling.
Yeah. No, I love that. And well, to talk specifically about sound, so I did this sound healing training. It was a year long, and we learned just a ton of different modalities related to sound and healing. The ones I gravitated towards the most were tuning forks, and the singing practices. And I think I really gravitated towards singing. I love when you don't need a lot of equipment to do something. I think that's also why I've gravitated always towards writing.
Yes.
So yeah, the voice is something that is pretty easy to work with in that way. And it's a direct experience. It's also, it's a direct line to our autonomic nervous system. Something as simple as humming a low note with like a slow, deep out breath triggers the vagus nerve, which moves us into like our rest and digest mode. Mm-hmm. So if we're very active, we're very stress activated. There are little tools like that, like humming. There's like just moving your face around, like the muscles in your mm-hmm. face have a direct relationship to the vagus nerve. It's like this vagus nerve is the closest to a magic bullet that I've found for finding regulation for myself. After years of doing seated mindfulness meditation, mm-hmm. It was like I found that, oh, box breathing is another one. So breathing in a square. Mm.
Will you explain what that means?
Yeah. So picking a certain amount of seconds, like I think 4 or 5 seconds is often a good place to start. You breathe in for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds. So that's it's equal on all sides. So that's why they call it square breathing. This similarly to humming brings you into that rest and digest mode when you're feeling stress activation, like increased heart rate, you're breathing really quickly. Those things that signal to us like, oh, I'm in a state. I'm in that survival state. It's a tool. It's one of my favorite ones. And then the tuning forks as well. There's a tuning fork that you apply directly to your body. It rings a lower note than you would think of with like the tuning forks that you listen to, but you can apply it right to the back of your skull where the vagus nerve is. And that one is also, I just started carrying that tuning fork around with me for when I would find myself in that state.
That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, I think it's always wild when you get to experience these things for the first time and you realize that sometimes one of the most helpful things that you can do is like something as ubiquitous as something that has to do with breath, like controlling your breath. And yeah, that how tangible that it can suddenly feel where like your brain chemistry, the sort of like adrenals and everything can be transformed and so quickly. Yeah, I'm also just thinking of the times that we've done choir sessions together and that we've had this kind of shared space that's about sound production that is not about that's not for recording, but sort of for the kind of energetic commerce or like a, I don't want to use the word commerce because it feels like it's about like an economy. But I think that you were one of the people to, or you had this thing in which you called choir a non-utilitarian vocal ensemble, which I always found so helpful as a sort of way of thinking of assembly, that utility didn't have to be foregrounded as a way to be with each other, and what that gives space to when we're able to sort of be with each other in different ways and in ways that aren't so much about producing or creating a product. And it also just reminds me that you said something, I feel like you posted something a couple weeks ago, maybe time relativity is really weird right now, I don't know how long, but it was about your like everyone who is doing offline practice, who are doing offline forms of engaging with anti-racist training, combating white supremacy, that they are like, that work is valid. And in this sort of, I think both in the terms of creating like a resilience for fighting against systems of oppression in the long term, how important this is to me in understanding that, or just how other people post things like, you know, your Instagram posts are not going to dismantle white supremacy, that like a lot of the work that goes into doing these things has to happen offline. And it's, I don't know if you want to say anything specific about that, or maybe if there's a specific practice or organization or something that you're thinking of as far as, or even just the work or what's interesting or what has been helpful for you there in the offline space.
Yeah. And this kind of brings it back to your previous question, about how this informs like gathering and assembly. Because all the practices I just talked about, they're great to do as an individual. They are extremely powerful as an individual. They put me on the path towards like recognizing when I was triggered and having a tool to give myself some regulation. But all of that increases exponentially, I think, that healing, that regulation, that being able to move towards well-being when we're able to do that in community. And I do think that a big part of the uprisings for Black Lives right now is a movement towards, we want to be in a shared space. We want bodily co-regulation around organizing to stop harm.
Right.
Because that's another thing. When resilience is used, one of the people I was studying with recently, Stacey K. Haynes, talked about how resilience is misused when you talk about being able to send soldiers back into war faster.
Right.
Okay, they have PTSD. Let's just get that resilience training and then we can send them back faster. Mm. So the ways that we approach these relational practices, I think making sure there's explicitly kind of a desire to interrupt and stop harm from happening. Mm. In the case of the uprisings for Black Lives, it's like interrupting the harm of the state on Black people. Mm. And I think when we are more able to feel our bodies, we naturally move towards wanting to stop harm. Mm. That's an aspect, I think, of healing. It's like, okay, well, blood is starting to come back into the parts of my life and my body and my psyche that I've kind of numbed out because I couldn't be with what was happening. Mm. As that feeling starts to come back, I might want to be more in relationship to other people doing this work. So the way that that looks right now, I think it's really important. Yes, it's really important for people to be out on the streets doing that work. But I think we're also recognizing that a lot of people can't do that work for various reasons,
right,
whether it's being immunosuppressed or not being able to risk it because you live with somebody who's immunosuppressed. There are those things. So people are really having to expand their concept of what being involved means at the same time. There's this aspect of radicalizing our bodies to interrupt harm. And then there's also this aspect of like all of, yeah, like what you were saying about the offline work that has to happen, the coordination and the remote aspects of it. And so leaning into those practices being relational at a distance has been an interesting practice for me recently. And I think that can be done with sound as well. I think you and I both attended this, Pauline Oliveros deep listening practice, huge Zoom call with like hundreds of people.
It was incredible.
I wasn't expecting it to be as powerful over Zoom as it was, because it was a practice I'd done in person where you're with a group of people, you let out a note slowly, you tone while simultaneously listening to what other people are doing, trying to find another note and then matching that note on your next out breath. So you have everybody kind of modulating sound, doing this vocal expression that's triggering the vagus nerve. So it's putting people in this kind of restful but focused place that meditation is often after that. So this is like a group sonic meditation practice. And over Zoom, it was still really, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, I think I was shocked because I'd for many reasons been like, no, I don't want to do an online choir practice because I don't want to normalize the sort of reduction of corporeal bodily shared experiences for the real thing, like, I didn't want to have to do online versions to say that was going to suffice. But then this, I don't know, I don't want to think of it as like a replacement, but actually there is something really tangible, especially appropriate with it being rooted in Pauline and Pauline Oliveros's practice of thinking about soft, I don't know, like, active listening programs and software for people where it was like one of the first times in a while where I had a emotional response to something that I was doing with people over video, where I think we were all maybe probably in that time feeling a sense of screen burn, of being overwhelmed by just having to be on screens all the time, but then to engage with each other that way. And also this kind of cacophonous energetic presence, I think, that sort of appears when you are doing this with other people, that it really registered in the body. There was this moment at the beginning where we all held up the text of where we were located in the world, and you say, "Hi, my name is so and so, and this is where I am." And hearing even just this kind of cacophony of voices, I mean, what, it was like 500 people, something around that, yeah, and it was incredible. Yeah, it was such a great learning experience, and it has given me, I don't know, I guess just a different perspective even on, I mean, even just having a conversation like this over video or over audio that doesn't feel, I don't know, that there is like still a potential in doing these things that are, even if they are sort of like a temporary form of assembly or something, that these things can really work. I'm trying to remember, what was this terminology you mentioned something right before we started our conversation, and
oh, urgency addiction.
Urgency addiction. Yeah, so I wanted to have you talk a little bit about this term, because I think that maybe a part of also where we are at in the landscape of trying to acclimate to ongoing change and the uncertainty that sort of has become somewhat of a norm for what will happen in the next few months or years on this planet, that there is this kind of tangible, that I was just saying to Caroline, this like tangible anxiety in which all of the, or that producers or people who are trying to sort of make things happen feel this like, I gotta do it, and how challenging that is. Yeah, whatever you want to say about this is.
Yeah, so I first heard the term urgency addiction probably a month ago. As soon as the pandemic started, I just started signing up for a ton of Zoom classes on somatics and resilience, just to hear from different practitioners on the topic. And one of the practitioners from the Strossi Institute, which is where I was taking an online somatics class, talked about urgency addiction as this thing that happens when we're faced with stress. Is often a response to uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. Like our heart rate goes up, our blood pressure goes up, we start breathing more quickly, because to be faced with uncertainty, we often default to like the negative. We're like, the worst possible scenario is going to happen if I'm not certain of safety. And this is sort of an evolutionary thing that's built into our nervous systems. And what happens when you've got like adrenaline pumping through your blood is that everything feels like it's happening right now. It's like right now is the most important thing,
right,
which is a survival strategy. It's like, okay, I'm hyper-focused on the present because that's motivating all of my resources to get me out of danger. But like modern humans living in the middle of multiple intersecting systemic crises, it's like these are ongoing things, but our bodies are reacting as if it's like, right now, I need to survive in this moment. And there are a lot of people who are in the position now of having to navigate life moment to moment because of the pandemic, because of racism and oppression. So that is a reality for a lot of people. But I think it kind of crystallizes into like the nonprofit industrial complex.
Really, in this book you just sent. Sorry, keep going. I'll just ask about this text you sent.
Yeah. So this urgency addiction of like, okay, we have to solve this now. I feel it with climate change. It's like, okay, well, we can't talk about grief and we can't talk about racism because we have to solve the climate crisis because it's going to kill everybody, and we have to do it now. And that urgency addiction completely causes us to sidetrack all of these things that just feel like they'll take too long, quote,
right,
unquote.
Or expand outside of like problems that expand outside of our lifetime.
Yeah. And it's like the urgency and discounting of these things that we consider external to the important thing, which is like profit creation, essentially. That is what got us into this problem.
Right.
And it's not going to get us out of this problem. What's going to get us out of this problem is like extremely long-term visioning and some stillness and some regeneration, because nothing can just run on complete forward movement all the time. That's like the delusion of how our economy is shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Things need, biologically, we need rest for regeneration. So building in that rest and noticing when we're in that urgency addiction, is this really going to be the most intelligent and resilient strategy for me to just whatever pops up in the moment, be like playing whack-a-mole with that.
Right. And it does, I mean, also even just having, it's like what has happened for, I don't know, the last, somehow with, I think so many of us within the last decade of our lives have fallen into a rhythm by which we have chemically trained our bodies to anticipate the constant request of our action, our activity, our response, and that how hard it actually is to sort of get out of, retrain the sort of neurological system of the body to unlearn this and start to sort of examine, it's like what am I actually engaging with here on a day-to-day basis when I have to just like literally it's like the when the inbox has like become like a whack-a-mole, yeah, like you're saying, a whack-a-mole, being like pew 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 pew, how do I get rid of all these things? And then it's also like, yeah, it's like how are we it does require, I think, like you're saying, like it does require a slowing and a quietness and a listening that is maybe not so linked to the producing of content or the producing of material, which is so hard for institutions, I think, for producers, curators, whatever, to get around this idea, companies, whatever, to be like, yeah, like to be not producing is the sort of way in which we can sort of begin to focus on resilience in complex times. And that's, I mean, it's something I definitely struggle with as like, I was like touring around the world for the last 4 years. And like I just had like the first 3 months of not having to go to an airport for the first time since 2016. And I'm like, that's fucked up. I don't want to do that again. But so yeah, it is this thing too about like, I think also going back to what you said about a resilience that is, or a transformational resilience that it's not about trying to return to normal, that's just not a viable option for actually creating resilience because the world is ever changing.
Yeah. And you just made me think about how I totally jumped on the sourdough bandwagon when the pandemic started and I've been making sourdough. Yeah. It's, I have found it really like magical that I feel like an alchemist working with bacteria. Same. And like turning flour into something delicious.
It's actual magic.
Totally
it is like, it's like mad science magic where I'm just like, it also just makes you feel like your human capacity. Like, look, I can create something absolutely magical.
Yeah. And then trying to notice in the places where I'm like, oh my gosh, should I be starting sourdough bread workshops on my Instagram live? And should I start a bread business? And like, that's so habituated into our minds to turn everything into a side hustle. Mm. And the way that puts the emphasis on, cause that would ruin sourdough for me. If I suddenly was just like, I have to be productive. And I told this person I'm going to give them 5 loaves. And,
it's true.
But I've definitely lived in the economic reality where like, if I didn't turn every little thing into my life into a side hustle, I wouldn't make rent. Mm. So it's like, the way that the economy trains us to constantly be thinking of how to monetize things.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that for me, the pandemic has provided at least a little bit of a pause from that, where I'm like, I literally, if I'm thinking about producing more sourdough, it should be to give to the mutual aid network. It should not necessarily be for me to start like a Etsy sourdough starter in a cute bottle with maybe a succulent.
Yeah, and it's especially, I think, hard too when like a part of what cultivates that feeling in the first place is this environment where it's like, if you don't do that, someone is going to do it and be profiting. You know, it's like there's this perpetual awareness by engaging with digital platforms that like, if I'm not being productive right now, I know someone else will be productive. And I feel like that's a big part of, I don't know, narrating something different into dreaming something else into the present, which has to do with like actively saying, okay, like I do not need that. I don't need to cultivate, or like, I don't have to do this for profit. And that I think that for anyone listening, it's like, whatever thing you can find in your life that can be, give you joy and not have to feel as though it is about producing, profiteering, or bettering, like, it can, and trying to also cultivate space for that, I think, in the long term. I think maybe it's also just something that happens the older you get, the more you're like, wait a minute, what have I been doing trying to, like, hustle? But yeah, it is also, I mean, very much this thing about that you also said about it being economic, where... if you've lived in an experienced life in this way where you like also like, yeah, you're like, I just need to make some fucking money, then like that's gonna be how you live and work. And I feel like we could literally just do this. I should maybe say to also people listening that like Caroline and I had this conversation. We were going to start a podcast called Healing is Horrible, which I'm like, even in talking about our conversation about like producing things, I'd be like, wouldn't it be great if it was like a podcast and it just like happened when it happened? And it's just like, you know, and being like, oh, but I don't know. I really appreciate the language space that the cognitive space that I have shared with you over many years has always been such a treasure, and how fruitful it has felt for me to experience these conversations and take them in. We probably could just keep talking for hours and hours, but I'm wondering, you know, before we go, is there anything else that you, whether it's like a text or a video or a website, where you're like, oh, this thing has really made my change the way that I'm experiencing the present for the better. I don't know if there is, or if not, you know, that's also, it's like, you don't have
I mean, just closing with what you were just talking about, and to continue this thread of like, sometimes doing something for the sake of it feels good, mm-hmm. and not, it might not have results that are measurable by the market. Mm-hmm. You know, it has intangible results. There's value there. We've been trained to, by our economic structure, to believe that indulging in something that it's like Puritan work ethic stuff. It's like indulging in something that feels good is a waste of time. You should always be producing. You should always be, working in that mode. And so learning to, I think Rebecca Solnit, who's one of my favorite authors, she phrased it in one of her books. She said, learning to gravitate towards that which nurtures, which is what a plant does. A plant moves towards the sun because the sun is helping it thrive. It's not just surviving. It's able to thrive because of nurturance from the sun. So when I did the sound healing program, I went into it just being like, I'm just going to gravitate towards the instruments, practices, tools, and people that make me feel good, instead of this like weird fetishizing of suffering that I was doing before that, where it's like Buddhism is very much about acknowledging suffering. But I think sometimes there's a tendency that I think is reinforced by capitalism to just be like, all right, well, I'm suffering.
Gotta suffer more. Here comes more suffering.
Gotta suffer more. I'm just gonna really feel it. So moving towards just being like, oh my God, music feels good. This tuning fork feels good. That was revolutionary for me. And I would say the woman who ran the sound training, her name is Sylvia Nakash. Mm-hmm. And she was a facilitator of singing practices. She does something called Yoga of the Voice. Mm. I would definitely recommend her work either online, or she has a book that called Freeing Your Voice that comes with audio tracks. If I was going to recommend a text or a tool, a person, I think it would be her. She is, I feel like she's a mentor to me in facilitation because she's like a Grammy winning opera singer. Wow. Who does not use her voice in that way in group gatherings. She totally takes her ego out of it. She's like, this is not a performance. My goal is to get you all singing regardless of whether you have any experience, regardless of what it sounds like. Man. And she's such an expert at that. It's really amazing. I can't wait to be able to gather in person with her again at some point. It's one of the things I'm looking forward to about when we move into being able to do that again safely. Mm-hmm. And that just taught me such a lesson. And I think that's the most important thing about resilience that I would like to leave people with is, yeah, undoing some of that fetishization of discomfort and pain and suffering and moving towards what helps you thrive, what feels good to you, what is restful for you. Mm. Regardless of what that looks like to other people, because it's always going to look like doing nothing
right.
to some people. It's always going to look self-indulgent to some people.
Mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, that's huge. I mean, it's a really, I think, pertinent bottom line to negotiating or navigating the present and understanding or peeling back the layers of what has been, how we've been conditioned to live through this really strange time on the planet with really complex circumstance. I love you so much.
I love you so much.
And I'm so grateful I'm so happy that we got to have this conversation, and I really appreciate, appreciate what you have said, and, who knows? Maybe we're gonna do more. I guess.
I feel like maybe.
Yeah, it's quite possible. Well, have a lovely rest of your day. And
you too. It's always such a joy to talk to you and be in conversation with you.
Always a pleasure, never a bore, as I love to say.
Absolutely.
All right. Talk to you soon. Bye, Caroline.
Bye.
So, I wanted to finish out today's episode with just two activities that you could participate in wherever you are, whether you're listening to this at home or in your office or on a walk, that if you can find a moment to sort of engage in a sort of meditative practice. Maybe these aren't the best things to be doing if you're like driving a car right now, but you can always pause this and pull over if necessary. But the first thing I want to introduce is something Caroline mentioned called square breathing, which just slows the parasympathetic central nervous system. It's a natural tranquilizer, so anytime you're ever having this experience or physical sensation of fight or flight, you can always engage in this. And then in general, it tends to just be kind of nice way to give yourself a reset if you find yourself struggling emotionally or physiologically. So we can do this together, and I'm going to make a little soft metronome that you can use for your in count, out count, and holding of the breath. So again, it's six in, hold for six, exhale for six, and hold for six. And we're just going to do that six times. And you probably can notice that even just by taking some deep breaths, that in general, just giving yourself that oxygen. I think it's just always crazy to me that we don't have so many reminders in our day-to-day life that remind us the importance of taking a big deep breath or drinking a glass of water if we can. Yet these are fundamental things, I think, to living, to having resilience. So the final thing I want to finish it with is a kind of meditative vocal activation of the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic central nervous system. And the syllable that we're going to be essentially making sound to is wo, wo. So I will do this on my microphone. If you don't want to do this part, you can listen to me make some strange noises, or you can participate whenever you feel like it's the right time for you. So this exercise should be about sort of tuning into or paying attention to everything from your esophagus, your lungs, up into your throat, into your nasal cavity and your mouth. And feeling as though as you hold this long sound, you can kind of transform the awareness of where that sound is hitting. So we're just going to do six of these. So I'm going to start here with a big deep breath. Oh, and maybe before we start, I should also mention that you can hold the same tone as me, or you can hold any tone at all. So don't feel like you have to be pitch perfect every single time. It's less about pitch and more about breathing and producing sound. So here we go. Feels so nice to even do, even all here by myself in my studio. So you know, you can feel free to utilize this kind of, or I think maybe also, yeah, so maybe you might feel a slight somatic difference, both in terms of slowing your breath, but then also in sort of activating the parasympathetic central nervous system with these long held sounds. And you can feel free to use or misuse these anytime. Feel free to share this information or this episode with anyone who you'd like. And thank you for being game to come along with this little podcast experiment. And again, thank you to Walk and Talk for asking me to make this little episode. And I hope you enjoyed the time that we shared together. And who knows, maybe this thing will happen again in some other form. Otherwise, my name is Colin Self, and thank you for tuning in.